Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Bear by Andrew Krivok, read by Eric Jason Martin. We did not guess its essence until after a long time. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Essays, Second Series. Chapter 1. The last two were a girl and her father, who lived along the old eastern range on the side of a mountain they called the Mountain That Stands Alone. The man had come there with a woman when they were young and built a house out of timber, stones pulled from the ground, and cement they made by baking limestone in a fire. It was set halfway up the mountain's slope and looked out onto a lake ringed with birch trees and blueberry bushes that ripened in summer with great bunches of fruit the girl and her father would pick as the two floated along the shore in a canoe. From a small window in front of the house, the glass a gift the woman's parents had given to her after having received it themselves from the generation before, so precious a thing had it become as the skill for making it was lost and forgotten, the girl could see eagles catching fish in the shallows of an island that rose from the middle of the lake, and hear the cries of loons in the morning while her breakfast cooked over a hearth fire. In winter, the snows began not long after the autumn equinox and still visited the mountain months after the spring. Storms lasted for days and weeks at a time, drifts climbing up against the house and burying paths as deep as some trees grew high. Often the man had to wade for firewood or trudge out to his tool shed at the edge of the forest with a rope tied around his waist. But when the winds settled, the skies cleared, and the low sun shone again, the man would wrap the young girl warm and tight in a pack, walk out into the stillness of winter, and float on snowshoes made of ash limbs and rawhide down to the frozen lake, where the two would spend the day fishing for trout and perch through the ice. Snow covered so much of the girl's world from mountaintop to lake that for almost half the year all she could see when she looked out that window was a landscape at rest beneath a blanket of white. And yet, no matter how long winter lasted, spring followed, its arrival soft and somehow surprising, like the notes of birdsong upon waking, or the tap of water slipping in a droplet from a branch to the ground. As the snow melted, black rocks, gray lichen, and brown leaf cover emerged from the once uniform palette of the forest floor, and the thin silvery outlines of trees began to brighten with leaves of green against the groupings of hemlock and pine. Those were the days when the girl left the house in the morning with her father and studied a new world that pushed up from the dirt of the forest and emerged from the water at the edge of the lake. Days in which she lay on the ground beneath a warm sun and wondered if world and time itself were like the hawk and eagle soaring above her in long arcs she knew were only part of their flight, for they must have begun and returned to some place as of yet unseen by her, some place as of yet unknown. There was, though, one day among all four seasons of the year the girl loved best, the summer solstice, the longest day of the year, the day on which the man told her she had been born. And he made it a tradition to give his daughter a gift on the eve of the solstice. She didn't remember receiving the earliest ones, but she cherished them just the same. A carved wooden bird so lifelike it looked as though it could fly. A purse made of deer hide and sinew that was her mother's, and in which she kept colored stones found along the lake. A water cup shaped from a piece of solid oak and from which she drank, a painted turtle that walked slowly from the man's hands as he unfolded them, and which she kept for the summer as a pet, then released down by the lake in the autumn. On the eve of the year the girl turned 5, her father gave her a bowl of fresh strawberries after their supper and said, "I have a special gift for you tonight." He handed her a box made of birch skin, around which a long piece of dried grass was tied in a bow. She untied the bow and opened the box. Inside was a silver comb, polished brightly, and looking like nothing she had ever seen before. She stared at the comb for a long time, until the man broke the silence. "This was your mother's," he said. "I have been waiting to give it to you. When I watched you fighting with your hair down on the lake shore, I thought, this is the year." She reached into the box, took out the comb, and held it as she would a thing delicate and to be revered. "I love it," she said quietly, closed her hand around the comb, then climbed into her father's arms and hugged him. The girl had heard the voice of the man in her ear for as long as she could remember, so she never wondered if there was someone else who might have once spoken to her as well. But when she was old enough to walk beyond the house and into the woods or down to the lake, she began to notice something about the animals. There were two foxes darting in and out of the downed log den with their skulk of pups. Two loons escorted the baby loon across the deep middle of the lake every summer. And when she saw does grazing in spring in a small meadow at the base of the mountain, there were the fawns right by their sides. So after the girl had practiced running the comb through her hair, and the man tucked her into bed and kissed her good night, she looked up at him and asked, "Why are you alone?" The man knelt down at her bedside. "I'm not alone," he said. "I have you."
"I know," said the girl. "I mean, where did my mother go? Everywhere around me there are things you tell me were once hers, but she's not here."
"She's here," he said, "in what we remember of her."
"But I don't remember her," she said. "What happened to her?"
The man bowed his head and lifted it again, and he told his daughter that when he and the woman buried their parents and came to the mountain and built their house, she was all the world he knew, and he believed for a time that the two of them would live alone in this world for the rest of their days, until she discovered she was going to have a child.
"Me,"
said the girl. "You," said the man. But when the time came, she had to struggle a great deal to bring you into the world. And after that struggle, the only thing she could do was nurse you and rest. She was strong, strong enough to live through the summer and into the fall to give you what milk and nourishment she had to give. But in time I knew she would leave us for that place where the struggle to bear a child had taken her, and neither you nor I could follow. And one evening, before the hunter's moon, she went to sleep and didn't wake. The man turned away to look into the dark for a moment, then turned back to his daughter. She sat up and reached out from underneath the blanket and took his hand in hers.
"It's all right," she said. "I understand."
He smiled and said, "You're a wise girl, but there's still much you can't understand, so much you shouldn't have to. Not yet."
"Like what?"
she asked. "Well, like how even after all these years, years in which I've had you to think about every minute of every day, I still think of her. I still miss her and wish she were here." The girl lay back down on the pillow.
"Will I miss you one day?"
she asked. "One day," the man said. The girl was quiet then, and the man thought she might have fallen asleep, but she asked again into the dark,
"Are you sad that you have me instead?"
"Oh, no, not for a moment," the man answered in a voice too loud for the room, and held the girl's hand tighter. "Not for one moment. You see, you are the joy I have beyond any sadness or wish that remains for what once was. Without you." His voice trailed off, and he stared down at the floor, then back at his daughter. "Without you, I'd be nothing but alone," he said.
"And without you, I'd be alone," said the girl.
A hint of moonlight had begun to creep with the summer dusk into the house through the window, and the man could see traces of the woman in the face of the girl. "I know what we'll do," he said. "Tomorrow we'll climb to the top of the mountain where your mother is resting. She loved the mountain. She used to say the summit looked like a bear. I want you to see it too. Would you like that?"
"Yes,"
said the girl. "Good," the man whispered, and kissed her on the forehead a second time, and tucked her in tight. "Then rest well. Tomorrow we have a big climb." The girl rolled over and huddled beneath her blanket. and before the moonlight had left the window she was asleep. Chapter 2 She woke at dawn to the songs of a gray catbird and walked into the kitchen, where her father was making a breakfast of dried apple slices and mint-leaf tea. "It's a beautiful morning," he said to his daughter. "Eat, and we'll go." The girl rubbed her eyes and sat down at the table. She had awakened several times in the night and had not slept well. She had had a dream in which she was lost somewhere between the summit of the mountain that stands alone and home. But if she was uncertain about whether she could or even wanted to make the climb that morning, she kept these thoughts to herself. The man said her mother lay in the earth on the top of a mountain, and so she would try as hard as she could to get there, for her as much as for him. She ate in silence, drank her tea, and filled a gourd with water. Then she put on her thick deerskin shoes for moving over rocks and said, "I'm ready." There was a path, not worn but discernible. The first stretch of it was no more difficult than the walk to the house from the water's edge. As they climbed, though, the terrain became rockier, the trail steeper. By the time the sun had risen and the eastern and western shores of the lake were in full light, they had climbed with hands and feet up boulder after boulder to the midway point. There they rested on an outcropping of stone. The girl drank water and ate a handful of hickory nuts. Her forehead was sweating and her legs ached, but there was no turning back. From what she could see from where they sat resting, the climb to the top looked harder than what she had just done. The man wondered what was in her thoughts and said, "Your mother and I used to climb up here together every summer, but we were already grown by then. Do you know what that means?" The girl looked from the top of the mountain back at her father and said, "That I'm stronger than you?" "Yes," the man said, and laughed. "And I have a feeling you always will be." He stood and shifted the contents of the pack in which he carried the things he always took when he left the house. Knife, flint and steel, bone needle and sinew line, tree nuts, and his own gourd filled with water. "We'll rest one more time," he said, and set off up the mountain. His daughter rose and followed. They reached a craggy ledge at the base of the summit after noon, by the man's reckoning. The air was cool, the sky cloudless and bright. A strong and steady breeze whipped the leather skins they wore at their elbows and backs, and they stared at an eagle drifting on a thermal like a lone and defiant leaf in autumn. All the world they knew lay spread out at their feet. Mountainside, forest, lake. The girl asked her father if they could see the house, and she followed his sight line to where he pointed out a small patch of white oak shingles on the back pitch of what was the roof, visible against the never-ending cover of green and the thin trail of smoke that rose from the fire in the hearth. Then she turned to look up at the summit, no more than 20 long strides away, its jagged rock bereft of trees and exposed to countless days and nights of sun, snow, wind, and rain. Behind it was only sky, so that in profile the shape of that summit looked to her, too, like the head of a bear staring into the blue. And off to the side, as though on a shoulder of that head, she saw a cairn of rocks, on top of which was perched a large flat stone. She could feel her sweat cool as the wind pushed against her arms and chest, looked over at her father, and pointed to the pile. He nodded, and they made those last strides together. The cairn was wide, but no taller than a scrub pine. The flat stone that lay across it looked like a table, the surface smooth and empty of adornment. The girl remained standing at a distance, wondering how her father had lifted the stone and placed it there. "Go ahead," he said. "You can touch it." She walked forward and placed her hands on the marker, feeling for any words or carvings she might not have seen but might yet be present.
"Is she just beneath the rocks?" the girl asked over her shoulder.
"No," said the man. "She's buried in the ground below. The remains of her, as far down as I could dig. I wanted nothing to disturb her."
Her hand still floated over the top of the stone. "How did you move this by yourself?" she asked.
"I don't know," he said. "I only remember it was an autumn day when I started, and snowing when I finished and walked back down the mountain with you."
"With me?"
"Yes, on my back, in the same pack."
"And it took you that long?"
"No. Things change that fast."
"Tell me," she said.
So they sat down against the cairn of rocks on the side sheltered by the wind, and the man took a deep breath and told the girl that on the morning he woke and found that the woman had died in her sleep, he felt her great struggle had finally lifted, and he lay next to her for a long time until he knew what it was he had to do. He took the girl from her crib, gave her water and mashed beets he had cooked the night before, put her in the pack he had made to carry her, and began to gather wood of all sizes, beginning with sticks and limbs, then branches and whole logs from trees he had found fallen in the forest. With these he made an enormous pile on the lake shore, placing the driest and thinnest on the bottom, and the logs and limbs that would make up her bier on top. He stopped only to feed the girl, and it was twilight when he was done. Then he walked back to the house and carried the body of the woman in her blanket down to the beach, placed her at the top of the heap, and set fire to it as the stars were beginning to emerge in the sky. He remained awake all night, watching the funeral pyre burn, and in the morning rose to feed the girl breakfast, then climbed with her in his pack to the top of the mountain. He placed her in the shade of the ledge shaped like a bear and began to clear a plot of ground of rocks and earth. He wept for the woman and talked to the girl as he worked so that she would know he was still there, telling her how strong and beautiful her mother was, but that the time had come for them to say goodbye. And when he had removed as much stone and dug as deep a hole in the earth as he could, he hiked back down the mountain in full moonlight with the girl. He slept for a few hours, feeling the temperature plummet in the night, but having no strength to light a fire. And at sunrise he went down to the lake shore and gathered up the woman's bones and ashes and wrapped them in the blanket that had covered their bed. Then, with the girl once again in the pack on his back, the man carried the remains of the woman to the top of the mountain that stands alone, laid the bones and ash in the shallow grave, covered it with earth, and piled stones three deep on top of that earth. "And when I stood up and looked out at the north," he said to the girl, "I could see the storm coming. I could smell the snow. It would be summer before I was able to return, and I wasn't even sure then that I wanted to return. I felt a rage at your mother's death, at my loneliness, at everything in nature. It was then I saw the stone. I had been walking around it for the past 2 days. I reached down, cradled it in my arms, and howled as I lifted it with all my anger and all my strength. I howled so loud you began to howl with me, and the wind on the mountain was filled with our howling. But I wanted something to hold her memory as well as her remains, and nothing could stop me until I placed that stone right where you see it now." The girl was silent for a long time, her father silent too, with his head bowed.
"I wish I could remember her," she said finally. "Something about her. But I don't."
"You were too young," said the man.
"Sometimes, though, in my memory, it's not just you and me," the girl said. "Sometimes there's another. So close I can't see a face, but someone is there with me."
The man nodded. "I know," he said.
"What did she look like?" the girl asked.
The man thought for a moment. "You'll see her the next time you look at the surface of the lake," he said.
"I want to come visit her every chance we get."
"Let's make the climb every year," said the man. "On the longest day, the first day we were all together. She would like that."
"I would like that too," said the girl.
Then they rose from where they sat, sheltered from the wind, and walked back down the mountain. Chapter 3. The man began to teach the girl what he knew of the lake and the land that summer. He showed her where to dive for the mussels they boiled and served for dinner with a plate of wild onions. He taught her how to make a rabbit snare and a dessert of cattail rhizomes and rosehip jam for the meal they caught in the snare. He took her step by step through the fashioning of a fishing spear from a sapling split into fours at the top, with the points sharpened and lashed to stone spacers, which she practiced throwing at the fish caught in the weir they had built in the cove on the lake. He taught her how to take sinew from and tan the hides of deer he had shot with a self-bow made of hickory, how to hunt for swarms of wild honeybees when the goldenrod bloomed before the autumn equinox, and how to take honey from the tree where those bees had built their hive. And when they were at rest on the lake shore in the heat of the day, he taught the girl how to approximate time with the noon mark he had placed on an old and worn erratic come to rest long before on that grassy shore. When the nights were clear, he took his daughter outside and taught her how to look at the sky, pointing to the stars along the ecliptic and telling her the names of the constellations that traveled there. In summer, she learned to find the hunter Sagittarius, the heart and tail of Scorpius, and the four bright stars of Hercules. In winter, on snowshoes of her own, her father took her onto the frozen lake and pointed out the great Orion, his dog Canis Major, and Sirius, the brightest star in the sky, the one that makes up the dog's nose. And all year long they watched the Big Dipper revolve around Polaris, a star that could be used as a guide, he told her, if she ever found herself uncertain of the way home. As she got older, the man taught the girl how to read and write in the long evening light of summer and around beeswax candles during winter on nights when there were no stars to be seen in the sky. For a tablet, he used a piece of tin, for a pencil, a charred stick from the fire. When she became adept at writing, he gave her paper bound between leather covers and a graphite pencil, which he kept sharpened with his knife. She asked him at once where he had gotten such paper and pencil, and he told her only that they had been with him for a long time. Although she loved the paper and the feel of the pencil between her fingers, in truth, the girl tolerated her writing lessons. Reading was what she loved, and never more than when she was listening to her father read to her. He had books that were his father's, which he handled gently and kept on a wall of shelves in their small house. He read poetry from poets with strange names like Homer and Virgil, Hilda Doolittle and Wendell Berry, poems about gods and men and the wars between them, the beauty of small things, and peace. He read stories true and not true, stories about a house in the woods, a hunter and a mermaid, and rabbits in search of a home. And when he was finished and had blown out the candle, she would always ask, as though making certain she was back in her own world, "These others, they're gone too?" "Yes," he would say, "for a long time now."
"And we're alone?"
"Not alone. We have each other. Now, go to sleep, and I'll see you in the morning." As she began to study and decipher for herself the words in the books the man read to her, those stories of struggle from long ago came to life again, as though she were hearing them for the first time in her own voice. That was how, without having to leave the peace and quiet of the mountain, she learned so much about what had been and why it had been that way, from tales recounted in old words of an old time on old pieces of paper bound between cracked and fraying covers. Yet after she had become a fine reader herself, the girl still asked her father when she was ready for sleep to tell her a story, one he had heard when he was young. "I'm not so old yet," he would say, then think of something that had surprised him that day. Begin with the words, "My father once told me about a time," and from there weave a story about a long journey taken, a triumph of great strength, or a treasure lost and found. Sometimes the tales came from the land around the mountain. Sometimes they came from a place far away the man only imagined. Always they ended back in the small house, safe and warm around the hearth fire. Toward the end of the summer in which the girl turned 7, when the man had finished following her across the lake in their canoe, for she had become a strong swimmer, and they were resting on the grass, he told her how he and the woman had made the canoe, walking a great distance north to find the white cedar for the ribs, thwarts, and gunwales, then collecting black spruce roots to use as lashings and heating spruce gum to seal the bark seams. "This same canoe?" the girl asked, looking again at the boat she had taken back and forth across the lake ever since she could remember. "This same one," he said. "It has lasted this long." And in the fall of that year, the girl and her father watched a bear emerge from the woods and walk toward the lake, splash about in the water until it had a fish in its mouth, then set off back into the forest and up the side of the mountain. The animal reminded her of its profile on the mountaintop, its place next to her mother, and the questions the girl had had when she first climbed the mountain, the most private of which was why, if her mother was so strong, could she not have lived to remain with them? Rather, it was as though she had wandered off like a bear, passing through the forest. "Was my mother a bear?" she asked out loud when the animal with bluish-black fur and a blaze of white on its chest had disappeared into the trees. The man laughed and asked, "What makes you say that?"
"She didn't want to stay with us," said the girl. "She went away, up the mountain, just like that bear."
The man understood then what the girl had been thinking. "That bear would not have stayed even if you had asked," the man said. "He looked like a boar to me, with that massive body of his and massive feet. Male bears are content to wander, and so that one was doing what he was meant to do. I was the one who took your mother up the mountain, remember? She wanted nothing more than to be here with you. But we don't get to choose when we leave here to sleep on the mountain. We all have to sleep on the mountain one day. Even the bear. Even when we struggle with all our will not to." The man was silent and looked down at the ground for a long time. Then he lifted his head and said to the girl, "Come here." She walked toward him until they were side by side. "Sit down and take off your shoe." She did, and he asked her to look closely at it. The tanned deerskin, the even stitching, the worn but impenetrable sole. "Your mother made that shoe," he said, "when you were still a baby in her belly. She made 5 pairs of shoes from deer she and I hunted with the bow. Each pair she made is 1 size bigger, so that by the time you outgrew the last, you would be able to make your own."
"Is this my last?"
"Yes," the man said.
"How could she have known to make 5, asked the girl, "if she wasn't sure she would be leaving us?"
The man shook his head, as if to wonder. "Maybe she did know," he said, "and so she thought of a way in which she could stay with you, year after year, right at your feet, until you were grown enough to understand that we all have to leave." One day, at the edge of autumn, while they lazed in a hammock the man had strung between 2 pines, the girl asked if there were any more bears in the forest, or just that one they saw in the summer. "There are bears still," said the man. "They come and go, but keep to themselves."
"I like that the mountaintop looks like one, and that it will always stay right where it is," said the girl.
"That's why I put her there," the man said. "The bear is a companion to her while she sleeps. I hope one day I'll sleep there, too." The girl was quiet for a moment, then asked,
"What are they really like?"
"Bears?"
"Yes. Are they nice?"
"They're shy," the man said, "if that's what you mean."
"I mean, will they roar at us and come eat our food if they're hungry? The real ones?"
"No," said the man. "They don't roar unless you bother them, or threaten their young. My father once told me they will travel a long way to do good, for their own or another. It's a promise they make when they are very young, whispering it to their mothers even before their eyes are open." The girl swung slowly in the hammock,
wondering what a bear's whispered promise might sound like, until the man asked, "Would you like to hear the story my father told me?"
Sample complete. Ready to continue?